were thinking about Amour de Voyage that you're not going to reread it? What?
He liked it.
I kind of like it, yeah. I mean, it's not the kind of love poetry I'm used to, but it's still kind of...
Not what you would send someone for Valentine's Day?
No, definitely not. Yeah.
The ongoing project.
Yeah. But it does give me a sense of, you know, it's this interesting perspective. Like, it wants... Actually, I want to get into it and see how it ends eventually.
Uh-huh.
And I was talking about the cantos, actually.
Yes.
The ones in between. Those are my favorite part.
And the italics, in italics, yeah.
And for a weird reason, it kind of reminds me of the love song J. Alfred Prufrock.
Huh.
Yeah.
And that was how we got to talking. Yeah. I think you'll reread it later in your life, apparently, that you're in high school, that you will appreciate later.
Yeah. Okay, well, I don't know if you'll ever appreciate the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock. just saying.
You do.
No, I mean, if you don't, will you ever?
I was told I'd appreciate it in 40 years. So.
Sorry?
Because we were talking about doing it in high school, and I did Prufrock in high school. We read it with the intent of rereading it in 40 years, and appreciating it and enjoying it.
At that point.
Okay, but
so
you haven't yet.
I'm excited for in 40 years.
Oh, okay. But
I liked it at the time, so I can only imagine it'll get better.
I think he was 23 when he wrote it.
Are you?
Oh.
Yeah. No. It sounds like a poem.
I'm so
of,
mad.
It,
these like.
It sounds
incredibly
like
incredibly talented poets that are 23-year-old.
Someone Google it just for a second. You can get your phone out.
Which one?
Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. I'm not confident that I'm right that he was 23, but I think he was 23 when he wrote it. Elliot. You know, I grow old, I shall wear the bottom of my trousers rolled.
And Child Roland to the Dark Tower came was written in a day.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Well, they had less to read back then, so.
Yeah, that's what it was.
And they definitely didn't have iPhones.
Because they had all this convenience for the stuff they had to do. It's like you could just sit down and you could actually dictate Child Roland to the Dark Tower came because there was really good voice recognition software at the time.
Birthday's not, like, I can't find when
he was born. He was born in 1888, I believe. So when did it come out? The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock? Okay, we'll figure it out later. okay, so Clough. How many people have finished it? How many people have started it? Oh, boy. Okay, then. Well, remember we have an exam. How are the papers going? Yes.
We were also talking about
two seconds. Yeah.
Say it again.
I thought I would actually finish it last night and bring it to the writing center this morning.
Uh huh.
Before my own shift starts, but then I've got like about a third of what I imagined, so I just canceled the appointment.
And I think he's farther along than any of us.
Okay, well, you know, it's you can pull your Tuesday night all-nighter. That's fine. Let me know if you need an extension.
Is it just by end of day Wednesday that you need it?
By EOD, as they say, or by COB? Do you know those?
I do. I actually work.
Do other people? I figured. I know that. Do other people know that? All right, get it to me by EOD. COB is close of business, so that's not... You would prefer EOD to COB if you needed slightly extra time.
Personally, yeah.
You said, but you said COB! What do you mean EOD? I mean, or whatever. You said EOD, what do you mean COB? Okay.
Else I thought you would want us to bring it printed to class.
Yeah, that's what
you can either bring it printed to class or email it to me as a document. Do not email it to me as a PDF. Because that's a real pain to grade, but either on paper or as a document, which is much easier to comment on. So half of you have started it. Well, that's good. It's an amazingly modern poem, and which is not quite the right way to put it, because there aren't modern poems like it. But it certainly doesn't feel like a non-modern poem. It doesn't feel even like a Victorian poem. It's very novelistic. The kind of a novel it would be is called what? Do people know what this sort of novel is called?
Epistolary?
Uh-huh, epistolary novel, which is, say, a novel in letters. As you probably know, in the last few years, there have been the text-based versions of these novels and texts. Soon there'll be Discord chat novels. There are. I don't think they're good, but... Wouldn't you, if you found someone's phone and it wasn't locked, wouldn't you read their texts? No. You're such a good person.
Like the last thing I'd want to read.
Well, there is that, but it might depend who it is.
Yeah, that's where you learn everything.
Okay, so the first novels in English arguably are epistolatory novels. That is, novels in which the main characters are writing each other. Often you will have a main character and a confidant of that main character, and then the other main character and the confidant of that other main character. So you will have, to use the most famous and greatest epistolatory novel in English, arguably the greatest novel in English, but I'm not going to argue it. You have Clarissa writing to her friend Miss Howe, and you have Lovelace writing to his friend, and they are describing what's going on in their relationship, and Clarissa is... this is Samuel Richardson's novel, Clarissa. Clarissa is writing about how she's getting more and more persecuted by Lovelace, and Lovelace is writing about how he's having more and more fun persecuting Clarissa. It's not a happy novel. It's a tragic novel. It's not... It's in no way a fun novel. But epistolatory novels are... the great 18th century novels are a lot of them epistolatory. If anyone's ever seen the movie Dangerous Liaisons, definitely worth seeing. It is based on an epistolatory novel. It's quite scandalous and shocking. The novel is great. The movie is great. And the movie stars John Malkovich. So is that a plus or a minus? Should be a plus. I saw him potting on his porch in Cambridge once. He had a potter's wheel and he was potting. So that was really cool. He has a house in Cambridge. You sometimes see him walking down the street. At any rate, that is based on a novel by Rousseau, or what Dangerous Liaisons is. This is just general cultural history. What Dangerous Liaisons is a really vicious take on a novel by Rousseau, whom everyone was obsessed with, that novel being called Julie or the New Heloise, and that is Rousseau's kind of version of Clarissa. And Dangerous Liaisons is basically about corrupting an innocent young woman and getting her to have sex with someone who despises her, but convinces her that he loves her. But he and his best friend are doing this. His best friend is really into the idea that she can get her best friend to do this to this young woman. But eventually things fall apart in all sorts of different and fascinating ways. But it's both raunchy and troubling. So at any rate, epistolatory novels. And then what you get is something that in a sense makes no sense on the in the context of epistolatory novels, which is that what epistolatory novels are novels that... the author can claim to be the editor of. That is what Richardson says in the preface to Clarissa, what Rousseau says in the preface to Julie, is for some reason that I can't go into here because it would give too much, it would bust too many people, I came into possession of this sheaf of letters. And I am now going to publish the relevant ones so you can see what happened to these real people, even though I've changed their names to protect the innocent. And So the idea would be, or if you've read Frankenstein, you know that Frankenstein begins with letters, right? So Mary Shelley at first was going to imagine that at least a little bit as an epistolatory novel. And in fact, the whole thing really is a letter. That is, it is the, what's his name, Warburton? Walton, that's right, Walton, describing what happened. And then he says, so finally, because we're stuck in the ice here, I can't write you a letter every day, so I'm just going to write, I'm going to tell you the whole thing. So the idea is that these are letters that exist in the world in which they describe. In epistolatory novels, something that can happen is that someone can find a letter that we've already read and say, wait, what? That is, they can read a letter that they shouldn't be reading. And the information can change the course of the story. That happens very frequently in epistolatory novels. But the basic idea is those letters exist in the world. That world is our world. And the reason we can read these letters is that an editor has found them, some person has found them, and has decided to publish them. And the letters existed in our world. Now the published version of those letters exist in our world. And some of the letters will tell what happens when earlier letters have been found. So we could say, this is, I think, an interesting thing to know about narrative and to think about in narrative, is that there are two kinds of fictional worlds that a novel can describe. One is a world in which the novel does not exist in that world. So let's say you read Portrait of a Lady, and now it was 10 years later, and you were reading another novel by Henry James with different characters. Those different characters would not go to a bookstore and see a copy of Portrait of a Lady in the bookstore, because that would be a different fictional world. What you could say is of fictional worlds, they often describe the real world, but with the slight difference that not only do the fictional characters not exist in that real world, but also the novel that describes those fictional characters will never exist in that fictional world either. This is more obvious in third-person novels, but it's kind of interesting in first-person novels. That is, that what you have is a first-person novel where a character is also the narrator of the novel, which means the character does two things. The character marries Rochester, for example. What am I referring to? Jane Eyre. Good. And the character says to you, to me, to all of us, what?
Reader,
I married him. But nevertheless, that reader does not belong to Jane Eyre's world. That reader is in our world. Jane Eyre never sits down to write Jane Eyre. So maybe Lockhart does sit down to write Wuthering Heights, but maybe.
I doubt it's Lockhart.
Yeah, well, okay, I mean, officially.
Yeah.
But Jane Eyre never sits down to write Jane Eyre, which means that the Jane Eyre, but it's Jane Eyre who says, reader, I married him, because Charlotte Bronte did not marry him. So the I there is Jane Eyre, the him is Rochester, the people who just got a spoiler are you. But the sentence, reader, I married him, is not a sentence that was ever written in her world. And you, the reader, are not someone in her world. So in first-person narratives, there's something interesting about the way the narrator, this is true of third-person narratives too, but it's not quite as interesting, the way the narrator straddles the real world and the fictional world. Okay, does that make sense to people? So in epistolatory novels, the first person narrator always exists in the world that she's writing about and is a real person in that world, and the writing that she's doing is writing that exists in that world. So that is a general feature of epistolatory novels. Sherlock Holmes, you know, the novels exist in the world that Watson is writing about. He says, okay, so I told this one story about Sherlock Holmes, and I published it, and then Holmes came to me and he said, Watson, you're wrong. That's not what happened. I don't like the way you describe me in your novel. So in your account of the case. So in this case, I'm going to try to do it a little bit better, he says. So there's an example of novels, of texts. We won't call them novels because they're true in that world, of texts that exist in the world that they describe. Epistolatory novels are texts, are full of letters that exist in the world that they describe, which means they can be found, which means that their materiality matters in a way that in a novel that doesn't exist in the world that it describes, its materiality, the fact that it is a thing, that it is an object that you can buy it at a bookstore, that isn't an issue. So most contemporary novels, but not all, don't exist in the world that they describe, even if they're in the first person. Some do, most don't. Catcher in the Rye, no, it really doesn't. No one is going to say to Holden Caulfield, when did you have time to write all this down? And given the fact that English was your one good class, why'd you write it down in this really bad grammar? No one is going to say that to Holden Caulfield because it's a voice rather than a thing that exists in that world. Okay, is that a distinction that makes sense to people? So that's, okay, good. So whereas here, I know that a lot of you haven't started it, but just to take a look at some at one of the epistolatory moments, if I can find it quickly. So it's one of the P.S.'s, and it's a P.S. by, yeah, if you go to page 242 to give an example. So here's Georgina Trevelyan to Louisa, their audience friend, whom they write to so that we can know what's going on. And she's describing the fearful scenes we have witnessed and then describes this fearful scene, and we'll talk about this a little bit. Just by way of giving you some context, but George has just seen Garibaldi dressed up in a long white cloak, horseback, riding by with his mounted Negro behind him. This is a man, that is the black man, you know, who came from America with him out of the woods, I suppose. So she is not exactly the most sophisticated or admirable person in the world. Our Georgina is not. Out of the woods, I suppose, and uses a lasso in fighting, which is, I don't quite know, but a sort of noose, I imagine. This he throws on the heads of the enemy's men in battle, pulls them into his reach, and then most cruelly kills them. So just so you know, everything Georgina says is wrong. I mean, it's not factually wrong, it is morally wrong, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes, and we are not supposed to agree with her attitude at all. All her attitudes are wrong. She's ignorant and self-righteous and conservative in the worst sense, reactionary. Mary does not believe, but we heard it from an Italian. Mary allows she was wrong about Mr. Claude being selfish. He was most useful and kind on the terrible 30th of April. Do not write here anymore. We are starting directly for Florence. We should be off tomorrow. If only Papa could get horses. All have been seized everywhere for the use of this dreadful Mazzini. So just so you know, Clough allows you to know that here's Georgina at her worst, which is kind of bad. Just look on the next page, right above where it says Claude to Eustace. That is the last four lines of Claude to Eustace's letter. Oh, could they but be allowed this chance of redemption, but clearly that is not likely to be. Meantime, notwithstanding old journals, honor for once to the tongue and the pen of the eloquent writer, honor to speech, and all honor to thee, thou noble Mazzini. So Claude is honoring Mazzini, whereas on the previous page, Georgina calls him this dreadful Mazzini. Claude is right. Mazzini was a hero of liberation. He screwed it up, and I'll give you a little bit of the background, unless someone looked on Wikipedia. But I'll give you a little bit of the background. But noble Mazzini is right, to the extent that it's dreadful, it's because he ended up making a bad tactical decision. But he was certainly noble. So at any rate, Georgina is saying, well, Mr. Claude might be allowed. Mr. Claude might not be selfish. He's useful and he was kind and so on. And Mary allows she was wrong about him being selfish. And then P.S., bottom of page 242, P.S., Mary has seen thus far. I am really so angry, Louisa, quite out of patience, my dearest. What can the man be intending? I am quite tired. Mary, who might bring him to in a moment, lets him go on as he likes and neither will help nor dismiss him. So Mary has seen thus far. What does that mean?
She's read the letter up to this point?
Yeah. So Mary read this letter. You know, I'm giving you the news. Here's the letter. And then, after Mary reads it, she adds a P.S. saying, this is not something for Mary to read. I really don't like that, Claude. That's what she's saying. So the point being, first of all, it tells you something about Georgina, her racism, her self-righteousness, and so on. Clough was a radical and an atheist. And believed in human liberation. He was one of the great 19th century radical writers. And by great, no, not that great, but actually really great. For someone who's not a writer whose name you knew coming into this class, although you will have known one or two of his poems, like Say Not the Struggle Naught Availeth, he is really pretty amazing. And he... witnessed the revolutions. Do people know about 1848 being a revolutionary year? So there was revolution all over Europe in 1848. He was in Paris, which was where the big revolution was in 1848. He was in Paris where he met Ralph Waldo Emerson, who was also in Paris. And Emerson was the most radical of American 19th century writers. And he and Emerson became close friends. Then Emerson went back to the U.S. after essentially the failure of that revolution, which Marx writes about. If you've ever heard the Marx title, The 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte. At any rate, Clough said to him, went with him to Liverpool, where Emerson took the boat to America. And Clough said to him, I don't know what to do without you. Everyone here is religious. Everyone believes in God. It's all ridiculous. And I just don't know what to do. And Emerson said, I hereby declare you the bishop of all of England, which is not a thing. So you can lead them out of the wilderness, that wilderness being standard religious belief. Then Clough went to Italy, and this poem was written in Italy on the dates that it describes. In 1849, after the failure of the Roman Republic, which is what the poem is partly about, Clough went to Boston, where he was unable to get a decent job. Emerson really tried for him. Emerson said, come to Cambridge and you'll do much better in America than in England, but he didn't. So eventually he went back to England. And then eventually he went back to Florence as because his health was in very bad shape. And then he got malaria in Florence and died. So he died young. I mean, not by your standards, but by my standards. He died at 42. So young enough, but...
certainly none of us want to die at 42.
No. But the point is that you shouldn't mistake in any way characters like Georgina for his attitude. And he makes that as clear as he can by having her give you the dreadful Mazzini at line 230 compared to what he himself believes, the noble Mazzini at line 249, so 19 lines later. So just to give you then a little bit more background there, if you look at the names, the crucial names here would be Claude and Eustace. And Claude is a kind of assonance, a kind of similarity of pronunciation to cloth. So it is... which is why I kept wanting to call him Cloth is how he did pronounce it. But Claude is a first name based on his last name and tells you how close Claude is to him. Eustace is actually, so this is a little odder, but the Eustace, if you take those sounds and reverse them, take the vowel sounds and reverse them, you have a u. Eustace, just take the vowels and you have a u, which is what name sounds like that? Someone not here today?
Matthew?
Matthew, yeah. So Eustace is based on Matthew Arnold. And he went to school with Matthew Arnold. Matthew Arnold's father was the headmaster of his school. He was good friends with Matthew Arnold and his brother. Do people know who Matthew Arnold is?
Dover Beach
guy? Yeah. 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 Other people heard of him? Okay, we'll be reading him. He is the poet that you should have most contempt for that we're doing in this class. Let's just put it that way. But one good thing about him was that he really appreciated cloth. One of the few good things about him was that he really appreciated cloth and wrote an elegy for him after he died. Actually, I'm not sure if it's in this book or not. Let me just look. That's how the alphabet goes. I keep forgetting. No, it looks like... Rix did not put the elegy for cloth into this book. At any rate, what you're getting then is a bunch of voices, and everything but the italics exists in the world that it describes. The italicized portions at the beginning and end of each canto are cloth, you could say, writing in his own voice. And so that is a frame. It's not a letter that someone in Rome is writing to someone in Florence or to someone in England or whatever. It is the poet himself, Cloth himself, writing about the poem that he's writing. So there again, that kind of ontology of the text comes up, which is the italicized portions are not something, for example, that Claude could read, that Mary could come upon, that could in one way or another be an item in the world of any of the characters. So that's just, I mean, this is all stuff we can get intuitively, but it's worth being explicit about. So just to give you, again, I know you're not up to this, or some of you aren't, but to give you an example, look at go to page 246. Or go to page 245. Bottom page 245. So first is Georgina being herself in her PS to... again, you can look at letter 15. So Georgina writes, Louisa, we're going to Florence. Then Mary writes a PS to that. So in this case, the PS is different. Do I like Mr. Claude any better? I am to tell you. And pray, is it Susan or I that attract him? So she has her little PS. And then Georgina has a PS after her PS, which presumably the whole point is that Mary doesn't see it. That there are PSs following PSs, and Georgina has seen Mary's PS. Mary has seen Georgina's first letter, but Mary does not see Georgina's second PS. Okay, so then end of canto, EOC as we say, COC, close of canto, and then italics. Is it to Florence we follow, or are we to tarry yet longer, e'en amid clamor of arms here in the city of old, seeking from clamor of arms in the past and the arts to be hidden vainly, mid arts and the past, seeking one life to forget. Ah, fair shadow, scarce seen, go forth. For anon he shall follow, he that beheld thee, anon, whither thou leadest, must go. Go, and the wise, loving muse, she also will follow and find thee. She, should she linger in Rome, were not dissevered from thee. And then, so that's the end of Canto 2. People know what the poetic form is that he's writing in?
Hexameter?
Yes. How many? The hexameter, yes. And what is the foot?
Is it dactylic?
Yeah, it's basically dactylic hexameter, as I'm sure you all recognized. What is dactylic hexameter? What's it famous for?
Was it the one that used by Ovid in
Metamorphoses?
Among others. So it was more like the classic, the Roman poet kind of style.
Yeah, Greek and Roman. Okay. It's what the Iliad and the Odyssey are written in, what the Aeneid is written in. It is the meter of the great Greek and Roman epics. So the way it goes, it's not something that is natural to English, although you could hear it after a while. But it's not like iambic pentameter, which even if you don't know you can hear it, you can. But the way it goes, so it's dactylic. What a dactyl means is a finger. A pterodactyl is winged fingers. A dactyl is a finger, and it's called hexameter because it follows the knuckles on a finger. That is, it's stressed or long or large, and then short. So basically, it's long, short. That's why it's called a dactyl, because it's finger. It's the rhythm of the shape of a finger. So I sing the forest primeval, the murmuring leaves. You know it? Can you do the whole line? Just the line. I didn't finish the line.
The murmuring leaves in the hemlock?
Yes. Yeah. I sing the forest primeval, the murmuring leaves and the hemlocks. Who's that?
I'm blanking. Longfellow. Just know I know the line.
Yeah, Longfellow, famous line. Mm-hmm. So it's da-da-da, there's the I sing the forest primeval, the murmuring leaves and the hemlocks. That's dactylic. His is looser, but it's essentially dactylic hexameter. Just to go back to what started us on this, part of what makes this not real is the same thing that makes a Shakespeare play not real, which is that people don't write letters in dactylic hexameter. And even if Claude might, because he's so weird, there is no way that Georgina is writing letters in dactylic hexameter. Oh, and I thought I would write you, my dear, in dactylic hexameter because I'm in a poem by A.H. Claw. That's not happening. So whereas letters from Clarissa or from Walton or from Pamela or from Lovelace could be letters that would exist in the world, letters in dactylic hexameter, really not. Then we get the italicized part. And this is Clough himself, or someone very like him, a speaker who is essentially the poet, reflecting on the poem that he's writing. So here is the question, should I now move to Florence? Is it to Florence we follow, or are we to tarry yet longer? Okay, do you hear it there, by the way? Is it to Florence we follow, or are we to tarry yet longer? So I don't want it to become sing-songy, but just so you hear the undertone. No good poetry except nonsense poetry is sing-songy. But there should be this undertone that the rhythm of the line is in a kind of counterpoint with. And so if you get the meter, you will get the counterpoint eventually that the rhythm is producing with respect to the meter. So is it to Florence we follow, or are we to tarry yet longer, e'en amid clamor of arms here in the city of old? So he's writing this contemporaneously. He was in Rome during the brief existence of the Roman Republic, which was essentially from the beginning of 1849, depending on how you count, to the beginning of July of 1849. And so what happens, the context of this is that Garibaldi is the great revolutionary general who is trying to establish a republic in Italy, in various places in Italy. And Giuseppe Manzoni is the great leader who is has appointed, actually he didn't appoint Garibaldi as general, but Garibaldi is his major general. And they are establishing the Roman Republic. The Pope, Pius IX, who at first seemed like he was liberal, turned out not to be. And he had left Rome in rage and possibly in fear at the end of 1848, and was against the sacrilegious secularization of the seat of the Roman Catholic Church. He was outraged by what was happening, and he got help from France, explicitly from France, to retake the Roman Republic. So it's a little bit like Ukraine now. And the French were ultimately more powerful than the Republicans, and through some combination of treachery and force of arms, in July of 1849, they retook the Republic. And Clough was in Rome while all this was happening, just as Eustace is in Rome as all this is happening. They're not expecting it. They were in Rome, and suddenly there is this Declaration of Freedom, this pitched battle going on, they're under siege, and so on. And so what happens is the Trevellans want to get to Florence where it's safe, and Claude has to decide whether to go with them, how to get them there, whether he should stay in Rome. And Claude is having the same experience, public experience, that Clough is having as he writes the poem. So there is something journalistic about the poem. These letters are not so very different from his diaries and from the letters that he himself wrote at the time about what was going on in Rome. This is firsthand witnessing, and there's one place where he describes seeing one of the French, member of the French force, killed. And he probably saw that. He probably saw, you know, he wasn't on the front lines. All the tourists, all the visitors were in places of safety in Rome most of the time. But he did see, or he has Eustace describe, I mean, has Claude describe an actual act of violence. He says, I saw a man killed. And it's pretty vivid where he describes it. So that's the background, more or less the background of this poem. There's a love story and a political story, and they are overlaid one upon the other. And it's not the case that that the political story is the background to the love story. The love story is what really matters. It's that the very fact of what's going on politically, the very fact of the kind of modern world that this is going on in, is one of the things that is getting Clough, an atheist, to be thinking in proto-Darwinian terms about what love could possibly be or what love could possibly mean. If it's not something divine, if it isn't something that transcends human life, if it's a biological imperative, then thinking about that biological imperative is A, what he's doing, and B, a weird thing to do. And he thinks about the fact that humans somehow have this weird, maybe biological tendency to want to think about their own biological imperatives, that there's something strange about the human interest in the arbitrariness, the materiality of human interest, something odd about the fact that we get interested in. What is it in our biology that makes us get interested in our biology? In a way, that is the not quite philosophical, but certainly interestingly cognitive question that is animating Clough. So you can see that in some ways it's a little bit like Tennyson, what we were talking about in In Memoriam. We live in this strange, arbitrary world, this strange world of matter in which meaning is not a thing. And yet, we ask ourselves what it means for meaning not to be a thing. And that is what Clough keeps doing. And that's what makes him radical and it makes him feel really modern. Even more so, well, not hard to feel more modern than Tennyson, but even philosophically, more modern than Tennyson. After he came back to England, since I mentioned Tennyson, after he came back to England and then went to Italy in the late 1850s, he became friends with Tennyson, who was in Italy at the time. He wrote this before In Memoriam came out, actually. But as you can see, it's about some similar, or as you will see, it's about some similar issues. You can see that there's a certain kind of simpatico between Clough's sense of what if life really is meaningless? What if meaning is simply an illusion? Can we ask what it would mean for meaning to be an illusion, or is that to fall prey to the same illusion as the illusion of meaningfulness itself? Tennyson is asking similar questions in a strongly erotic, in a context of erotic loss, that is the death of Hallam. And Cloth is asking similar questions in a highly intellectualized vein. Again, just to give you, I mean, I know we're sort of pulling up a whole lot of Victorian culture by our bootstraps as well, because Victorian literary history is not something that a lot of people come to college knowing anything about. And probably haven't for the last century. But did you? Are you?
No.
No one, right? Okay. But there, trying to think what you might know about him. Did people know who Cardinal Newman was? Mm-hmm. Who was he?
Oh, gosh. I'm trying to think of how I would situate him. He had to do with the Oxford movement and, yeah, I know I'm trying to, I can see how I would situate him in here, but.
No, that's great. Keep going. Just say what the Oxford movement was.
The Oxford movement was sort of a, it was a religious shift that was, that happened at mainly Oxford, where a lot of people were calling for, a lot of Anglicans were calling for kind of a return to a lot of sort of more Catholic medieval like traditions. It's connected in some ways to medievalism, but
yeah.
Sort of a wanting a more Catholic feel to Anglicanism that had developed over time. And some of them actually like did kind of just jump off and become Catholic.
Like Cardinal Newman.
Changed their mind. Yes. Just changed their mind and were like, actually, all of this is stupid. It was a really strong, it was very influential in a lot of ways in the culture.
Yeah.
Beyond just religious.
Right.
Stuff.
So one of the poets that we read already was Coventry Patmore, mm-hmm. who belonged to that movement. Remember, it's Great is the Truth. Excuse me. This is a cold I did test. The truth is great, will prevail when none cares whether it prevail or not. Another person we're going to read is someone named Alice Meynell, who's really quite wonderful. But basically, there was a movement towards what's called Anglo-Catholicism, which is what T.S. Eliot was. So this is Eliot again coming up. And then some of the Anglo-Catholics became pure Catholics, and what they said was that Protestantism, even Anglicanism, didn't take religious experience and the profundity and power and anguish of religious experience as it's experienced by religious Catholics seriously enough. And so the idea was to either make Anglicanism more like Catholicism and maybe eventually to reconcile the two, which is still a goal, or in Cardinal Newman's case, to become Catholic. Cardinal Newman's most famous poem is Lead Kindly Light. And so that, if you know that phrase, it's a poem of Newman's. He wasn't a poet, but he wrote a few poems. But his most famous book is a book called Apologia Pro Vita Sua, that is an apology for his, an account of his own life. So he was someone whom, before he became Catholic, Clough was very convinced by. But what he found himself convinced by was not Catholicism is right, but Anglicanism is wrong. And so Clough was led by Newman not to becoming a Catholic, but to becoming an atheist. Because for him, atheism was serious. That was confronting the world seriously. For Newman, Catholicism was a serious confrontation with the world. So the gesture, the appeal was look at the world seriously and not through the blinkered hopefulness of some religious doctrine. And for Newman, Catholicism would do that, but Clough said, no, only atheism will do that. So that, again, is part of his attitude. And it is, you can feel a lot of anguished courage in Clough, or courageous anguish in Clough. And again, it's one of the things that makes him feel modern. If you think of modern literature, 20th century literature, in Western Europe, let's say, as being primarily secular, being primarily atheist, not secular as in religion doesn't matter, secular as in religion is wrong. And there's a whole lot of modern literature you can see that way. Clough is really anticipating that, anticipating it pretty powerfully. So that's a thing, again, to know about him. Okay, so what he does, what we'll do in about 5 minutes or so are a couple of his shorter poems, and then you can finish reading. You can finish reading this for Wednesday. But going back to that moment then, the italics on page 245, here is the poet saying, so should I go to Florence now? Or should the muse linger in Rome? Top two lines of 246. Go, and the wise, loving muse, she also will follow and find thee. She, should she linger in Rome, were not dissevered from thee. So the muse is going to stay in Rome, but she is still going to think about Mary in Florence. And then italics at the beginning of Canto 3. Yet to the wondrous St. Peter's, and yet to the solemn rotunda, mingling with heroes and gods, yet to the Vatican walls, yet may we go and recline while a whole mighty world seems above us, gathered and fixed to all time into one roofing supreme. Yet may we, thinking on these things, exclude what is meaner around us. Yet at the worst of the worst, books and a chamber remain. Yet may we think and forget and possess our souls in resistance. Ah, but away from the stir, shouting and gossip of war, where upon Apennine slope with the chestnut, the oak trees immingle, where amid odorous copse bridal paths wander and wind, where under mulberry branches the diligent rivulet sparkles, or amid cotton and maize peasants their waterworks ply, where over fig tree and orange and tier upon tier still repeated, garden on garden upreared, balconies step to the sky. Ah, that I were far away from the crowd in the streets of the city, under the vine trellis laid, oh, my beloved, with thee. So here he is in Rome. And where can he go? He can go into a room which is filled with books. At the worst of the worst, books and a chamber remain. And when he does that, he can imagine being on this hilltop. But he's staying in Rome. And a thing, again, about Rome, you'll see all this as you reread it for Wednesday. The thing about Rome is for him, for both Claude and for the narrator, and the difference between Claude and the narrator is that Claude is actually having an erotic adventure of sorts, meeting people, talking to them, making decisions about what to do, writing letters to Eustace. Clough is in Rome writing this poem and imagining the plot of the poem, but the descriptions of Rome that Claude gives and that he gives are the same. they both have the same attitude towards Rome. The only difference being the story is fictional, but what's going on in Rome, the public fact of Rome, is real. And the public fact of Rome is it's under siege. There are these battles on the 30th of April, which is the one that we looked at, that terrible 30th of April. What happened was Garibaldi repelled the French who vastly outnumbered them, but they were repelled. So that's why Georgina says that dreadful 30th of April. But for the Romans, that's an amazing day where they were able to repel the far superior forces of the French. That Garibaldi was able to do that. So that really happened. But the other attitude that they take, and this is important, this is where Claude and Clough agree, is that what's great about Rome is classical Rome. What's great about Rome are the statues to the Roman gods, the buildings that were built in pre-Christian times. And what they don't like about it now is that these places are now filled with Christian iconography. That there's a cross up on the roof, that where there used to just be statues. That all of what's amazing about Rome has been turned into Christian symbolism. And so the interest in Rome is in everything about it that's pre-Christian. I don't mean pre-Christian as B.C., I mean pre-Christian as before the establishment of the Roman Catholic Church at Rome. That is what they find amazing, and that's what they find Catholicism has repurposed in ways that mistake the, you could almost call it, the atheistic power of Roman art, Roman sculpture, and so on. Not that the Romans were atheists, but that our attitude towards those things is not one of belief. It's one of aesthetic wonder, aesthetic power at what they've done. And so he feels that way also about some 16th century painters, that even though they're painting Christian scenes and so on, that's not what's important about them. This is very much a brief for secularism. And the liberation of the Roman Republic is a belief in secularism. So there's one point, let me just see if I can find it quickly. If you go, this is Georgina being a moron again on page 236. This is letter 13. Dearest Louisa, inquire if you please about Mr. Claude. He has been once at R and remembers meeting the H's. Harriet L. perhaps may be able to tell you about him. It is an awkward youth, but still with very good manners, not without prospects, we hear, and, George says, highly connected. Georgie, this, by the way, is George Vernon. Just so you know, Vernon and George are the same people. Claude calls him Vernon because it's this English thing where you call other men by their last names. The women call him George because it's this English thing where you call people by their first names. So Georgie declares it absurd, but Mama is alarmed and insists he has taken up strange opinions and may be turning a papist. What's a papist?
Catholic.
Yeah. Why? Because he's not being an Anglican. He's not being a good English believer. Certainly, once he spoke of a daily service he went to, so he went to church, or so it sounds. Where, we asked? And he laughed and answered, at the Pantheon. So people know what the Pantheon is? Anyone ever been there?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's McDonald's right outside it. Just in case you get hungry. But there wasn't then. Where? We asked, and he laughed and answered, at the Pantheon. Then she explains, this was a temple, you know, and now is a Catholic church. So that part is right. It was a temple, now it's a Catholic church. And though it is said that Mazzini has sold it for Protestant service, yet I suppose the change can hardly as yet be effected. Adieu again, evermore, my dearest, your loving Georgina. So what does she get wrong? She reports something, presumably accurately, that Claude has said. How is she misunderstanding it?
She thinks that this means that Claude is becoming a Catholic.
Because
he's trying to, yeah, he wants to go to Catholic services and buildings and stuff, but that's not his intent.
Yeah, so what was his joke that she didn't get? So he says he went to service at the Pantheon. Sorry?
About it being at the Pantheon?
Yeah. Yeah. So the joke is, yes, I went to services to the Roman gods, mm-hmm. which, of course, the point is that he went as a lover of art. Mm-hmm. But she understood him to mean that he went to church at the Pantheon, where the whole point is Mazzini had stopped it from being a church anymore. This is part of the revolutionary activity of the Roman Republic that Mazzini and Garibaldi are engaged in, and that Claude is and Clough are all for, but that Georgina just simply doesn't understand. Her misjudgments are, she's the kind of character whose misjudgments are there so that we can orient ourselves by what she's getting wrong. She is at times faintly ridiculous, almost at times the fool. What am I quoting? No, I'm not King Hamlet, nor was meant to be. I'm an attendant lord, one that will do to swell a progress, start a scene or two. At times, almost ridiculous, at times almost the fool. It's the love song of Jaffa Prufrock. Just saying. So, that's Georgina for you. And she will, the way she gets Claude wrong is something that casts a sort of negative light on how to get Claude right. That's always an interesting literary device, is for someone to get someone else wrong and for the reader to know just that very fact that they're getting someone wrong. So just again going back to this question, at the end of Canto 3, Clough is staying in Rome. And Claude, why is he staying in Rome? Claude is staying in Rome. Or it might be better to say, why is Claude staying in Rome? Since he's an invented character and Clough can decide what he's going to do. Because Clough wants to stay in Rome. And so he says, okay, yeah, I'm going to stay in Rome. And then first letter right after that is Mary to Miss Roper, who turns out to be her tutor, who's still in Rome. She writes on the way to Florence, why doesn't Mr. Claude come with us? You ask. We don't know. You should know better than we. He talked to the Vatican marbles, but I can wholly believe that this was the actual reason. He was so ready before, and when we asked him to come and escort us, certainly he is odd, my dear Miss Roper, and so on. So, but the real answer, why doesn't Mr. Claude come with us, is because Clough wants to stay in Rome and describe what's going on there. So there you see an interesting version of the interaction between the italics and the Roman. Okay, let's go just to look at a couple of other moments in Clough, and you really finish Amour du Voyage for Wednesday. It's not, you know, if this were a novel class, you'd be doing so much more reading. Just saying. Okay. This is one of his most famous poems, the one that's called The Latest Decalogue, page 262. So what's a decalogue, anyone?
It's
What does that mean, that word?
10 years later.
No, 10 is right. Deca, as in decade. So Decalogue is a Greek name for the Ten Commandments. So there's a movie called the Decalogue. There's actually a series of movies, one for each commandment, called the Decalogue. But it's just a word that means the Ten Commandments. Okay, so who wants to read? Let's go around the room. Eileen, you can start reading the first commandment.
Thou shalt have one God only. Who would be at the expense of two?
Okay, so first commandment is, anyone remember what it is in Exodus or in Deuteronomy?
There is no God but God.
Yeah. I'm the Lord thy God, who brought thee out of the land of Egypt to be thy God. I'm the Lord thy God. So there is no God but God. So here it is. Thou shalt have one God only. Why?
Why would you want to deal with two?
Yeah, why would you pay for two gods? It means two churches. It's a real pain. So here is a very practical Peter Thiel-like 19th century version of the Decalogue. Thou shalt have one God only. Who would be at the expense of two? Next. Sophia.
Graven images may be worshipped except the currency.
Okay, so what don't you worship according to Ten Commandments?
Any graven image, like idols.
Idols. What graven image can we in this updated Decalogue worship?
Money.
Money, yeah. Engraved portraits of Benjamin Franklin. So no graven images may be worshipped except the currency. Okay, Sam.
Swear not at all, for thy curse, thy enemy is none the worse.
Yeah, so what is the original Ten Commandment?
Thou shalt not take
the name of the Lord thy God in vain. Yeah. That is by cursing someone, by saying, God damn you. Mm-hmm. So why shouldn't you swear now?
It doesn't really do anything. It
doesn't do any good. We all know that. So swear not at all. For thy curse, thine enemy is none the worse. Samantha.
At church on Sunday to attend will serve to keep the world thy friend.
Okay, original.
Thou shalt keep holy the Lord's day.
Yes, honor the Sabbath day and keep it holy. So that's what you should do. You should go to church on Sunday, on the Sabbath day. Why? Yeah, out of hypocrisy. People will admire you for going to church. So why do people go to church? Because they're hypocrites. That's this fourth commandment. Irina, fifth commandment.
Honor thy parents, that is, all from whom advancement may befall.
Yeah, so who should you honor?
Superiors who might help you move up in the world.
Yeah, anyone who can help you. So parents is a metaphor for anyone who can help you if you suck up to them, if you brown nose them. So honor thy parents. Whom do I mean by parents? All from whom advancement may befall. Okay, Quinn?
Are you a fan of The West Wing?
Sorry?
The
West Wing. Yeah.
In the pilot, this is my favorite part of the pilot. Honor thy father is the fifth commandment. thou shalt not kill, but needs not strive officially to keep alive.
Officiously.
Officiously, you're right. Officiously to keep alive.
So what does that mean?
Don't murder anyone, but also, you don't...
You're not obligated to try not too hard to keep people alive.
Yeah, you don't have to work to help people. Yeah. Earthquake in Turkey... Sad. What's on the other channel? So I actually saw this quoted the other day in the Boston Globe on I think it was in the Boston Globe in a story about assisted suicide. And the writer of the story said, this was bizarre to me, that everyone gets this wrong, that what they think that this is about is that it's okay to let people die when, you know, that this is really good, serious advice to doctors, that when people are in really at the point of death, you shouldn't use heroic measures. And that's not what he means. What he means is, if you can help someone, you should. And but the way things look to us now in these selfish times, don't actually kill people. That would be bad, you know? That would be bad, as they say on South Park, because, you know, killing people is bad, right? But you don't have to work hard to keep people alive either. Okay, Leon?
Do not adultery commit. Advantage rarely comes of it.
Yeah, so why shouldn't you commit adultery?
Makes your whole
difficult.
Yeah, it doesn't help. You might think it'll be fun, but it's just going to get you into trouble. So really, it's prudent, like going to church, it's prudent not to commit adultery. Juliet?
Thou shalt not steal an empty feet when it's so lucrative to cheat.
Yeah, why steal when you can cheat? I mean, seriously. Just sell some crypto. You don't actually have to steal. You can just sell some crypto. Good. Okay, I'll lean again.
Bear not false witness. Let the lie have time on its own wings to fly.
So what does that mean?
The truth will come out, so just let it happen.
Actually, it's not that the truth will come out. It's you don't have to do it. The lie is going to... You don't have to push it. If someone thinks that someone has done something wrong, you don't have to say, yes, I know they did. The rumor is good enough. You don't have to get your hands dirty. The lie is going to fly around the world anyhow. Be not false witness. Let the lie have time on its own wings to fly. Let the lie develop by itself. You don't have to add to it. You don't have to add baking soda to the yeast. So to speak. Sophia.
Thou shalt not covet. The tradition approves all forms of competition.
Okay, so what's the original? What shouldn't you covet?
Other people's things.
Yeah, your neighbor's wife or his house or whatever. No, don't do that. Because there's something you can do more that's better than coveting what your neighbor has, which is what?
Competition.
Yeah, compete. It's capitalism is competition. Competition is good, as Ayn Rand has told us. And, you don't have to just say, oh, I really wish I had a beautiful estate like that. Just work for it. Much better than simply wishing. So the sum of all this is, Sam? Keep reading.
At any rate, shall never labor more than thyself to love thyself.
So what's that saying about religion? The sum of all the commandments is?
Love God.
Because? If you're loving God.
Than loving other people.
Yeah. So remember what Jesus very famously said and what Hillel said. Is to love thy neighbor as thyself. That is the whole of the law, is what Jesus says. But here he's saying, no, the sum of the Ten Commandments is, sure, go ahead and love God. That's easy. No cost at all. You can feel good about yourself. Oh, yes, I love God. And that means that you don't have to love your neighbor, at least not more than yourself. You can say, I'm a good guy, I love God, and that's a description of hypocrisy. So this is a great poem about hypocrisy. Yes, I keep the Ten Commandments. Turns out they're really convenient. I don't keep the Ten Commandments because they're morally correct, because they're the right thing to do. I keep them out of convenience. So it's actually a really funny poem. Thou shalt not kill, but needs not strive officiously to keep alive. Or thou shalt have one God only, who would be at the expense of to. So you can see the nature of his atheism, what its moral and ethical background is. And he's, I'll just say, you know, he's an amazingly smart and daring and original and uncompromising poet with a sense of humor. He's actually really very cool. Read Amour de Voyage for Wednesday. We'll talk about it more then. Okay, see you then.